Hey folks, this week we're doing a best of show because it is the Easter holiday and I am out doing things with the family. So we've put together some clips from recent shows to put together this best of show for you, and I hope you'll enjoy it. And see you next week live right here on Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. Real quick, here's a new randomly generated political rhetoric for you for this week. Know this, that I have faith in our glorious future, our right to accrue foreign debt, and our sacred family values.
So I want to go ahead and bring Katie on. Let's see. Katie, are you with us?
I am, Ken. It's great to be back on the show.
Hey, we really appreciate you coming back on the show. We've had actually a number of folks. Hemp is probably the number one topic we get asked about on the show, and I don't, you know, want to have it on every show, although I'm sure there's plenty of information. Our other listeners might get a little annoyed if we turned it into the Kentucky Industrial Hemp show. but I do think there's been a lot. I think it's been almost a year since you were on last, and I think there's been a lot of changes both at the state and federal level, and things are starting to move, and people had a lot of questions, and you and I have talked off the show about some of the things. You know, honestly, I don't know all the details, and so I wanted to get you on the show and let you explain to folks where we are at this moment with Kentucky, with the federal laws, what, you know, kind of where the laws are, and then what's happening now and where we're heading. So I guess let's start with the state. Have there been any changes to anything at the state level after we passed the industrial hemp bill?
No, actually, we have not changed anything with regard to state law, and that was kind of up for discussion, and I think it probably will help if I start from roughly last year this time when we passed the hemp bill in the Kentucky legislature. We passed the industrial hemp bill, which would allow us to regulate and grow industrial hemp for research, for commercial purposes, for whatever we need to do. And after that, you know, we kind of were in limbo for a while. We had several months pass where we felt like, all right, well, we passed the bill. Now what do we do? Nobody really was ready to move forward. The Ag Department wanted to get clarification from the federal government that if we moved forward with industrial hemp, it wasn't going to cause any legal issues for our farmers. And
right.
So we kind of were pressuring different organizations in the federal government for some kind of clarification. Rand Paul actually sat down with Attorney General Eric Holder, and you know, that's a meeting that you probably wouldn't hear about too often. But they sat down, and Rand tried to convince him to give us a waiver or give us some kind of clarification, and letting us know that we could legally move forward without federal intervention. And at this point, you know, we knew that on the state level, we're all good to go. We just wanted to make sure, you know, for our farmers and for our activists and individuals who wanted to get involved with industrial hemp, that nobody was going to get in trouble. So letters were sent to the Department of Justice. Letters were sent to the DEA. I mean, there was a lot of pressuring and kind of nagging going on from the state level to the federal government and requesting that they give us clarification. And we never really heard anything back. Now, we had some letters that went to representatives in different states, and we had some things that kind of gave us a little inkling that, you know, maybe we'll be okay if we just move forward with this. But what really sealed the deal was just recently during the passage of the Farm Bill, and that was just here in 2014. It either passed last month or the month before. I'm not sure exactly how long it's been. But when the federal legislature passed the Farm Bill, there was a provision inserted into that Farm Bill. It was 2 pages long. It was a very simple 2 pages. And, in fact, you can actually read those pages if you go to Facebook, you go to my website, Kentucky for Hemp. If you look up Kentucky for Hemp on Facebook and scroll down a little ways, there is a link that you can click on. It's a link to Vote Hemp's website that will allow you to see those 2 pages from the Farm Bill. Now, what that did in those two pages was it allowed any states that have legalized hemp on the state level to move forward with pilot projects, either through their departments of agriculture or through a university, and allow those pilot projects to actually grow hemp for research purposes. Now, it's not the ultimate goal. We have not reached our ultimate goal of actually growing hemp commercially, but what that did was it allowed Kentucky, because we've already passed our legislation on the state level, our agriculture department, our commissioner of agriculture, they're in full support of this, so it allows us to actually grow hemp for a pilot project. And what we're actually going to do is grow 6 different pilot projects across the state of Kentucky, and two in eastern Kentucky, 2 in central Kentucky, and 1 in western Kentucky. And each of those pilot projects will focus on a different aspect of industrial hemp farming. So while we have not completely legalized hemp for commercial purposes, we have at least gotten over that first hurdle of what we needed to do to actually bring some seed into the country and do some research and essentially make sure that these varieties of hemp will grow well in the United States and in Kentucky.
Okay. So rewinding a little bit.
So that's essentially where we are right now.
Okay. Well, I want to rewind a little bit. I know at the state level, before the Farm Bill was passed, there was a bit of a debate on whether we could go forward or not. I remember Agriculture Commissioner Comer said that with the Justice Department basically green-lighting, actual full-blown marijuana growing in other states and sales and whatnot, that basically greenlit us here. And then I do know that Attorney General Conway said, no, it doesn't. And so that was... boy, that's been almost a year ago, I think now too, maybe 9 months ago, during that debate and during the limbo period. And I really think that, in my opinion, I think Conway missed a key opportunity to actually step up for the hemp movement and just say, hey, if they're going to legalize the full-blown marijuana, then certainly hemp is fine. One of the things that we talked about last week, one of the callers called in and asked about hemp, and he mentioned that the current policy for full-blown marijuana, now we have the hemp bill, or the farm bill, and the hemp is basically, at least what we've done so far, is protected there. But because it's at least currently a Department of Justice decision not to prosecute marijuana, that, you know, the next administration can come in and undo that. And, in fact, there is a push by certain people. I know the House passed a bill out of the United States House that I think it's just the House that said that it was basically it was a wimpy impeachment, basically. It was, hey, you're not enforcing the laws. You need to enforce the laws. And in particular, a number of Republicans focused on the marijuana policy. So I do think it's very important that the federal government did clarify that we can go forward with at least getting started with hemp. So I guess the next part is what's happening now. Where are we in the state of Kentucky? What's up with the pilot programs? Where are we now?
Well, right now, each of the pilot projects have been basically, the teams for each project have been set up. They've selected universities that will work with each project, and they've selected what we're kind of, you know, quote-unquote calling team captains for each pilot. And so each of the pilot project captains are working on bringing seed into the country or finding seed, acquiring seed somehow, and essentially setting up their pilot projects and laying out all the plans, because obviously this isn't something that we can just do in one day and then that's it, we're done. This is going to take us a year. I mean, it's going to take an entire growing season to grow it. It's going to take we're going to need several weeks to actually wet the stalks. We're going to need time to process. We're going to need, you know, time to do all of this. So it's a very long process. And that's kind of at the stage right now where we are. We're in the planning process of the entire pilot project. So obviously we're still a little bit early in the season for planting, and I think that each of the projects are essentially in the same boat, where we're all just kind of, because the farm bill just passed so recently, we're all kind of scrambling around to get our farmers together, get our seed together, figure out how we're going to get this harvested, how we're going to get it processed, what are we going to do with the final materials when we're finished. So while there's plenty of different opportunities and different things we could do with it, it's just a bit of a rush to, figure out exactly what each project is going to do. And
You're saying that we are going to grow this year. Is that what you're saying? There will be hemp grown in Kentucky this year?
We will be growing industrial hemp in Kentucky this year.
That is wonderful. Wonderful news.
Mm-hmm. And I wish, I absolutely wish that we were growing it on a large scale, but the projects are not going to be very big. The goal of these projects is to make sure that, you know, the seed that we've got, the seed that we're bringing in will grow here, is it something we can use for commercial purposes. The University of Louisville is doing their project on bioremediation. So they're actually growing hemp on an industrial site where the soil has been damaged and the soil is tainted. So they're going to, see how hemp actually can remediate the soil and clean it up and help to make that soil better. So each project is going to focus on different aspects of industrial hemp. There's a project that will be done, I believe it's with the University of Kentucky, that is actually going to focus on CBD research and extracting CBD, the compound CBD from industrial hemp to use as a treatment for epilepsy in children. So we've got quite a bit of, interesting projects going on here.
Yeah, and that is actually really interesting. It's not just a matter of will it grow, but also what can we do with it. I think that's a good thing. I think it's not really a question of will it grow. It's going to be a question of what strains grow the best. Because,
that's
one time,
exactly right.
Kentucky was covered in hemp at one time. So, I mean, we know it grows. I am very interested. One of the things that doesn't get talked about a lot in industrial hemp is the bioremediation, the cleaning up polluted soil with hemp. And I think that's something that, mm-hmm. That to me is extremely interesting, because that's something that, today, if you go to a polluted site, the EPA declared a Superfund site, you're spending millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars while the EPA takes all the soil and digs it all up and takes it somewhere and buries it in a very deep hole and then has to bring in other soil to, reclaim the land. And it's really, really expensive. And, I'm as against pollution as the next person. Who's for pollution? Raise your hand. So I think that it is an interesting and exciting prospect to be able to use something natural based on how hemp is correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not a very deep-rooted plant, and that's why it's able to do a lot of the bioremediation, soil contamination cleanup. And I think that's something that holds a lot of promise as well, not just for somebody that wants a hemp shirt or, hemp paper. We hear about that stuff, and people are like, well, there's no real market for that. But I do think that there's a real market for bioremediation, for cleaning up pollution. And the CBD, the medical stuff for kids, is a great thing. And I thought, and I don't know if you followed this or not, but I thought they were trying to pass that bill here in Kentucky as well.
Yeah, I know. I actually have not followed that bill very closely, but I know that, they are trying to pass bills with regards to using hemp as medicine. There's actually several bills.
And I think it's important, again, to reiterate,
I'm sorry, but
The phone lag. I think it's important for the audience to know, to reiterate to the audience, that there's really three separate issues, right? There's industrial hemp, there's medical marijuana, and there's full-blown legalization of marijuana. And there's really three separate issues. And so
right.
It doesn't really surprise me you haven't been following the other two. Your focus has been industrial hemp. I just didn't know if you had been following it as, you know, aside or not. But we do have some other folks involved that have been following that bill, and so maybe we can bring them on in a future show as well. I guess the point is that it sounds like everything's moving forward well. Are there any concerns or any issues that you see going forward at this point?
Actually, you know, there are some issues, and for example, we don't have conventional equipment here in the United States for the most part. I mean, I'm sure there's some somewhere, but for the most part, we don't have conventional equipment that's equipped to harvest industrial hemp. You know, the stalks for industrial hemp are very tough. The fibers are very strong. So a lot of our harvesting equipment is not adequate to harvest industrial hemp and has to go through different modifications to get it up to par. And I think that we've overcome some of those obstacles because, you know, once we got to the point where the Ag Department said, yes, we're going to move forward with this pilot project, we actually had different groups and different organizations that kind of came out of the woodwork and said, hey, we're already growing canaf. We're already harvesting canaf. And if you've ever seen canaf growing or being harvested or processed, it looks very similar to industrial hemp. So we've got some groups that have, you know, miraculously appeared that are, you know, already capable of doing the harvesting and the processing of this. In fact, we've got, you know, different organizations that have processing equipment that can actually be used on site. So it's one of those things that, you know, as a good friend of mine always says, obstacles create opportunities. So when we have obstacles like the harvesting equipment doesn't work, or you know the combine doesn't go tall enough to cut off the tops of the seed, you know, where the seeds are in the industrial hemp. It creates opportunities for companies like International Harvester or John Deere or you know Case to kind of step up to the plate and meet those demands that our farmers need. So
how cool would it be?
So yeah,
how cool would it be to have a Kentucky company actually start producing the equipment to farm industrial hemp as well to harvest it. You know, that would be jobs, which, you know, there's been a lot of talk about will this have a significant impact on the economy. I think it will, and I think that it's not just the direct hemp. It is those secondary things. It's the harvesting. It's going to be warehousing. It's going to be the processing. It's going to be all those other things that aren't necessarily directly just the hemp. It's not just the farming. It's what happens afterward. And
absolutely.
I am very happy that Kentucky's kind of taken the lead on this. It's not often we can say that. And the upside of that is that it puts us in an advantage. And if we can really develop our industrial hemp marketplace here and not just growing the hemp, but also building the equipment or developing whatever, the processing plants or whatever, we have a real opportunity to actually have real economic benefit from something that pretty much we know will grow anywhere in Kentucky.
Absolutely. And as far as the market goes, you know, one of the things I was discussing with one of my counterparts here in the hemp movement is that you know, hemp can be used to create plastic pellets that are essentially the same as the petroleum plastic pellets that companies use to make everything and anything out of plastic. So if you are looking for a market, just look around your house. Look at all the objects in your house that are made out of plastic, and then imagine that object can be made out of industrial hemp with no retooling of equipment. I mean, it's exactly the same process. You're just putting a biodegradable, earth-friendly plastic into the machine as opposed to, you know, it was petroleum-based product. So,
yep.
You know, like I said, when you're looking for a you know, market for things, look around your house. Look at all the things that are in your house that are made out of plastic. Look at your computer and your printer and your, you know, little space heater and children's toys and umbrellas and food, you know, cutlery and that kind of thing. I mean, anything you can think of, you can make out of industrial hemp.
Yeah, I know. If I remember right, at least it's urban legend. I've never done the research. Didn't Henry Ford build a car out of hemp?
Absolutely. And in fact, for anybody who's skeptical about that, it's very easy to find on YouTube. You can find a video of Henry Ford actually driving his hemp car around, and he actually takes a sledgehammer to the fender of the car. And it doesn't even put a dent in it, which is phenomenal, because that's something that you would never be able to do with our fiberglass or you know, metal door panels or anything like that. But it, you know, if you go to YouTube, quick search for Henry Ford hemp car, we'll find a very short clip of him driving around and taking a sledgehammer to his hemp car. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. I mean, that's... Katie, can you run down real quick some of the things that you've been involved with that have kind of, maybe even a quick history of why you got involved in this issue and where you've been on it?
Yeah, actually, I kind of got involved in the movement just simply because I saw that there was a need for the education, and I felt like I was slightly educated, slightly more than the average voter about industrial hemp. And the more that I started to talk to people about it, and the more I learned about it, and the more I was taught about industrial hemp, and I will say that, you know, I've had some absolutely phenomenal teachers in this issue, but I ended up as president or sort of acting president of the Kentucky Hemp Museum, which was a traveling exhibit. It was a big gutted-out van that was full of hemp artifacts and memorabilia from the last couple of decades, and you know, because of the work that I had been doing around the state to educate people about industrial hemp and talking to legislators and sheriffs and that kind of thing, I kind of was in the right place at the right time for a spot on the Industrial Hemp Commission, and that is it's actually a commission that's part of the Agriculture Department in Kentucky, which really kind of gave me a big jump on things. It gave me an outlet where I was able to, you know, access legislators more easily. It sent me to Frankfurt quite often, and that Industrial Hemp Commission really sort of upped the ante on what I was doing in regards to industrial hemp. So then I went from, you know, just going around and randomly talking to people and bugging legislators to actually, you know, being invited to come to different counties to meet with groups and organizations and sheriffs and judge executives and magistrates and all that kind of thing. So really, really the Industrial Hemp Commission, and that is still where I am. my term was expired on December 31st, so I thought I was going to be off the commission after that point, but apparently the rule is until they replace you with somebody else, you're actually still on the commission. So I am still a member of the Kentucky Industrial Hemp Commission, and that is really the reason that I've been invited to take part in the hemp pilot programs. And I actually didn't mention this, but the Western Kentucky Pilot Project, I will be overseeing that project. So that is in conjunction with Murray State University, which is in Murray, Kentucky. And we are actually studying European seed, which we're bringing in from Italy to Kentucky to see how it grows here. And we'll be studying the fiber and some different, you know, processes and things that we can do with the fiber from hemp, among other things.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, the Murray State, by the way, of all the state campuses, has the most beautiful campus of them all, for those that haven't been there, just as a side note. But,
it really is.
You know, it's beautiful. It's really a really nice campus. The thing, I guess, that I was wanted to bring up is that this is not really a relatively new phenomenon. It's been a grassroots thing that's been growing for a number of years. You know, a number of our listeners are familiar with Gatewood Galbraith, and Gatewood championed industrial hemp. But, you know, this has been something that from the grassroots, both on the left and the right, or at least the traditional left and right, has been something that's been going for quite some time.
Yeah, absolutely. Gatewood was actually the first person that exposed me to industrial hemp. And it was reading his book that kind of jump-started my interest in industrial hemp, where I was interested in liberty and freedom. You know, I was more interested in, you know, politics and just, you know, setting, you know, like Moses said, you know, setting my people free. I was interested in freedom for everybody. And so, you know, it was being involved in a grassroots movement for reducing the size and scope of government that I met Gatewood Galbraith. And then in reading his book, I kind of was exposed to industrial hemp and you know, that's it. I got bitten by the hemp bug and kind of just went crazy from there.
First impressions aren't the most important thing. They're the only thing. At Ernie's Print Shop, we'll produce what you need to represent your company professionally. Right now, you can get 1,000 full-color business cards, 1,000 4x6 postcards, or a 3x5 banner for just $60. You choose. Check us out at erniesprintshop.com. Ernie's Print Shop. Over 50 years, one source, one solution. erniesprintshop.com. 502-969-8585.
As a reminder, this is a best of show. We'll be back live next week. Until then, enjoy the best of. Coming up next is Obamacare in Kentucky. Here on Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network.
Lost in information. Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springson of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
Looks like we have David on the line, so I'm just going to go ahead and bring him on. And that's probably the best thing to do. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ted.
Hey, thanks for coming on. We've had a handful of requests, a handful of different topics that people often request of us, and definitely one of the top ones, if not the top issue, is the Obamacare issue. So certainly appreciate you coming on. You know, and I guess if you could give a brief, short history of where you're at with this issue. I mentioned at the very beginning that you've got a couple of lawsuits going in regard to Obamacare here in Kentucky.
Yes. When it comes to implementation of Obamacare, you know, from the federal legislation that we all are familiar with, the states have two main options. They have the option to decide to set up their own exchange, and what they get in exchange for doing that is a big mouthful of federal dollars up front, and then at the end of calendar year 2014, those federal funds all run out, and it becomes the state's responsibility to pay for all the costs of the exchange, the health benefit exchange, they call it. The other half of the equation is the Medicaid expansion, which when they originally wrote the Affordable Care Act, they made it mandatory. And the U.S. Supreme Court, by a vote of 7-2, said, no, you can't require the states to expand Medicaid. It has to be an option. And there's a process for doing both of these things. And I noticed when we were getting started, when Kentucky started looking at Obamacare, that we broke state law implementing the exchange, and then broke it again implementing the Medicaid expansion. And so I filed two lawsuits. Those are in the process. We've had several hearings, and now we're awaiting the Kentucky Supreme Court to have us hit to resolve these issues. But you know, at least to my mind, and to just a clear reading of the of state statute, we haven't followed the law on either setting up the exchange or accepting the Medicaid expansion. Meanwhile, the legislature could somewhat make the issue, they could somewhat clarify the issue by putting funding in the budget and authority in the in some form of legislation for the Medicaid expansion and the creation of the exchange. And they just now hitting the news. In fact, hitting the news that Rupp Arena is not getting their funding, but so far I haven't seen any of the reporters pick up on the fact that the Budget Conference Committee defunded Obamacare.
And so I want to rewind just a hair. I just want to rewind a hair here. When you say that the governor overstepped his bounds in setting up the exchange, or the state did, what you're speaking of is that the governor basically through executive order both expanded Medicaid and created the exchange. And
well,
that
he did an executive order for the exchange, and it wasn't by executive order, it was by administrative function. That was simply just done incorrectly to do the Medicaid expansion.
Okay.
It was too wrong.
Okay. So essentially what that means, though, is that, and as you mentioned, you know, the funding that he's been receiving to run this from the federal government is going to run out at the end of this year. And the state legislature has effectively said, no, we're not going to continue to fund this past, you know, or at all, I guess, not past anything. We're not going to fund it at all. So essentially that kind of puts the governor and the executive branch in a bit of a bind because they've now created this system, and they've got people signing up. They'll always try to tout how many people they have signed up, and you and I can talk about that in a moment. But now we're going to be looking at the end of this year at a system that has no further funding, no mechanism by which to continue. And that's on top of the legal issues of whether there was the right to set these things up at all.
Right.
So the question then is, so they did officially then take this out of the budget. So that there's, is there any chance they might try to sneak it back in or try to put it in somewhere else, or is it dead?
Well, it's, I want to give a nuanced, the answer in order to
sure.
be accurate is a little bit nuanced. Not completely dead, but at least part of it can't be legitimately reintroduced. Now, what I mean by that is the executive order that actually created the Kentucky Health Benefit Exchange actually expired last June.
Okay.
So what happened was that Beshear, at that point, illegally reintroduced an executive order to create the exchange. And so there's some effort that has failed so far to legitimize that executive order or to ratify that executive order. But even if they were able to do that, they're ratifying an executive order that was out of order to begin with. So in my mind, at least, and I think that any clear-headed reading of statute would find that there's no possible way that we can create the state benefit exchange, state-run benefit exchange, and go forward with that. It's a little bit more murky when you look at the Medicaid expansion, but to my mind and you know, my reading of statute there, that's a dead issue as well. Now, they can throw money at either one of them, but in terms of legal authority, it really is just about, by any reading of it, a moot point. But the legislature coming in and writing specific language saying there will be no state funding of Obamacare at all puts a serious dent in it. And now the governor can come in and strike that language. He has the right to do that. But then you've got a really hot political issue when it comes to the legislature's coming back and overriding his vetoes.
And I guess the question, or not a question, but touching on this issue about the reissuing of the executive order, I have a real concern on that front, you know, kind of outside Obamacare, but I think it obviously is being shown here. If the governor were allowed to just reissue executive orders over and over and over, wouldn't that give the governor the authority to create any law without any check and balance and just keep reissuing it over and over?
That's a fantastic question, and it really is the question at the heart of this whole thing. That, you know, whether you like Obamacare or not, whether you like the governor or not, or any governor or not, we have a process. It's in statute. You can look it up, KRS 12.028, and I'll repeat that again. I'll mention it again as we go forward. But KRS 12.028 is the statute that describes how the governor can issue temporary reorganization statutes, and then what has to happen with regard to those statutes going forward in order for its provisions to be implemented into permanent law. Now, what he's allowed to do with this temporary reorganization power is to come in when the legislature is not in session and create new bureaucracies and or write new laws and or create new taxes. But then clearly in the law, the legislature must come in, and immediately upon them coming back into General Assembly session, they must ratify the executive order. If they do not, it expires 90 days after the session ends, and anything created in that executive order goes away as if it never happened. That's what happened in 2012.
Right.
Deere wrote the first exchange executive order, expired at the end of 2013 General Assembly session, and the day that it expired, I had him in court. We were in court that day, and they walked up to the judge and said, oh, yeah, by the way, we just reissued this executive order. Well, Section 5 of that statute clearly denies the governor the right to do that and says that any attempt to reissue the provisions of an executive order without, you know, going around the legislature such as he's trying to do is not legitimate.
And I think it's really important for people to understand, and especially those that are in favor of Obamacare. You know, you have to be very careful about winning at any cost, because that cost can be very high. You know, in the future, if this is allowed to stand, what we're basically creating is a mini dictator that can just start doing whatever he or she wants to do, and then it would be up to the General Assembly to have to specifically undo those things. And even then, there's nothing that would stop the governor from just reissuing a new executive order that puts it right back into place. So you're basically rendering moot the legislative process completely. And so, you know, apply it to other situations. Pick your issue you're against and apply it to some future time where a future governor is for that issue, and rather than going through the legislative process, he or she just, you know, applies it and makes it so. And that's a very, very dangerous thing that, you know, whether you support this particular issue or not, that is setting a very, very dangerous precedent.
Well, I'm glad that you put that description on it, because I was going to pick a nit with your initial description as a mini dictatorship. It's really, I really wouldn't qualify it at all. It's an absolute dictatorship. That's what we're doing when we're allowing when we allow a president with his pen and his cell phone, so to speak, or I guess, you know, those were Obama's exact words, if you're allowing the governor of the state of Kentucky to just operate unilaterally in direct contradiction of state law and the tenets of a constitutional republic.
Yeah, and I guess that's, you know, a really big thing. So is that at the crux of both of your lawsuits? I mean, is that, or is that one or the other? Where does this issue particularly play in your lawsuits?
KRS 12.028 is at the heart of the exchange lawsuit. It's distinct in the Medicaid expansion lawsuit. There's a different set of statutes. It's actually KRS 205.520, a Medicaid statute that basically states that we're in favor, you know, the Commonwealth is in favor of going after federal Medicaid dollars wherever we can get them. And so I have challenged the constitutionality of that that idea that we, and the analogy I used in court was that we're like a drug addict at that point, and you know the legislature is the drug dealer, and we're just, you know, the drug dealer always says yes to the transaction. He's always pushing more and more, and that's just that policy, and it's that, you know, that doesn't. It doesn't bear out as a good idea, and certainly not a practice that we want to follow under Kentucky's constitution, or in the alternative, that it wasn't implemented correctly. And that actually happened, that we have an administrative process that carried out, it's little more than a rubber stamp, that when they do something through administrative review, and that's, you've seen that happen here a couple of times, in particular with the Common Core issue, when they had to vote on the science standards and actually voted it down, and Bashir said, well, I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. He's actually allowed to do that under state law, under KRS 13A. But there are timing issues that have to be met in order for those administrative regulations to be implemented properly, and he just botched it. He started too late on the Medicaid expansion.
And so if I remember correctly,
kind of a technicality, yeah.
Well, and if I remember correctly, the whole thing with the law, the way that works, is that they have written a law that basically, as you said, empowers the governor to go after any and all federal dollars in regard to Medicare. Medicaid, I knew I was doing that wrong. Medicaid dollars. And the problem there, though, is that our state constitution specifically outlines that, I guess this is a kind of a technical argument, but I can't remember. It's two sections back to back that basically say that the General Assembly is not allowed to give up their power to the governor, that they have to, there's a separation of powers that exists. It exists for a reason. And that
27 and 28.
The governor, Section 27 and 28. That even if the General Assembly wanted to say, you know what, Governor, you just take this on. You just do it. That's all good. You just take care of it. But they don't have the constitutional authority to do that. They cannot just do that without changing our Constitution.
Right. And one way of looking at that is that the legislature going beyond the bounds of constitutional Republican principles to give their power away, it's not their power to give away. It belongs to the people, and that is guaranteed under Section 2 of the Kentucky Constitution, which forbids the existence of absolute and arbitrary power, and arbitrarily giving their powers away to the executive branch or to the executive flies in the face of what we're about.
And Section 2 is by far my favorite section of our Constitution, that the absolute and arbitrary power over the lives, liberty, and property of free men exists nowhere in a republic, even in the greatest majority. I love that section because it really is, at its core, what a republic is supposed to be about, protecting the minority against the majority. And
Unique language unique to the Kentucky Constitution. Actually, Tennessee has something kind of close, but Kentucky's prohibition of absolute and arbitrary government is the clearest such provision in among constitutions anywhere. I mean, there's really not anything like that exactly in the U.S. Constitution either.
And what's interesting about that is that in our Constitution, a little bit further along, it specifically, because that's part of Kentucky's Bill of Rights, it specifically actually says that even just amending or adding on to the Constitution elsewhere cannot invalidate the Kentucky Bill of Rights. So even if there was a constitutional amendment that said, yeah, except when we want to, right? I mean,
right.
For whatever reason.
That's a great point.
They would not
great
be able Yeah, they cannot do that without, I guess, technically speaking, they might be able to amend the Bill of Rights themselves, but they would not be able to simply add on and say, oh, well, we added this later, in a typical amendment process, right? The later amendment trumps the earlier amendment. But in this scenario, because of the way that our Constitution is built, even if they added a new section to the Constitution somewhere along the way, as long as it's not incorporated into the Bill of Rights specifically, even that is trumped by the Bill of Rights.
Yes.
So that's wait, our Constitution is a kind of an unwieldy beast, and there's a lot of stuff in it, but the Bill of Rights is definitely, for those who haven't through the Kentucky Bill of Rights, take a moment, go to LRC, which is lrc.ky.gov, and click under Kentucky Law and Kentucky Constitution. and take a look at that, because our Bill of Rights is actually pretty darn strong. I would say that it
very
is
strong, and it's very brief. It should take you 5 minutes, but well worth your time.
Right. Yeah. And
yeah, I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, and then you go back through and you think about all the laws, and that's the funny part. As you read through it, you're like, if you cross over and you apply what's happening today at a state or local level, and you say, wait a second, doesn't that technically violate that? it is important, and I unfortunately have heard that many of our legislators just ignore the fact that the Constitution exists. They don't even use the document. And I think that that's very dangerous, because at the end of the day, the only thing really protecting our rights as citizens is our Constitution that, per the federal Constitution, requiring us to have a Republican form of government. Our Constitution is what outlines that Republican form of government. And if you ignore the Constitution, then do we even have a Republican form of government at all?
That's a great point. You know, in a budget hearing, it was either 2 years ago or 4 years ago, my state representative, Bob Dameron, was sitting there and making some argument, and actually it was David Williams, of all people, who said, well, Bob, that's unconstitutional. We can't do that. And Bob said, well, it's only unconstitutional if somebody challenges it. And that goes to your point. He said that on camera, that should be so abhorrent that whether you're a Democrat or Republican or whatever, that should be the end of someone's political career, no matter what else you say or what else you think or do.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like, robbing banks is only illegal if you get caught, is kind of like what he was saying there. And that's a very bad precedent to be setting as well. I mean, we have these rules, we have these laws, and certainly there are laws that I disagree with. But the solution is not just to break the laws. We have a process in place, and so long as that process is there, it should be followed. If you don't like the process, then you work to change that process. But you don't just ignore the process. You don't just ignore the law. You don't just say, whatever, I'm going to do what I want. Because at that point, there is no constitutional republic at that point. If everybody is in a free-for-all, and laws are subjectively applied, or even worse, if it's something where, it's illegal for this class of people but not for this class of people, you're setting up some really bad precedents over the long term, that in the end, whether you're the winner initially or not, you will end up on the wrong end of that at some point. And I think that's really the key, is that you may be for Obamacare, you may be for the exchange, you may be for the Medicaid expansion, and that's great, but ends don't justify means. And creating that legal precedent, I guarantee it will at some point in the future be used against you if that precedent is allowed to stand.
Yeah, and that's the point that I've tried to make to my Democratic friends repeatedly over this last year, that just because you can ram something through now, you'd best not do it, because we might have majorities and a governor here in a couple of years, and how excited will you be for us to use your actions as precedent and say, we don't have to wait for you guys for anything.
Right. And that's, I think that's the most important thing people have to realize, is that it's not even, yes, you can be against Obamacare, you can be against the Medicaid expansion, or you can be for Medicaid expansion or for the exchange. But it absolutely has to be understood that your party is not always the one in control. Your political desires are not always the train that the state is on. And if you allow this to go, and I have some serious concerns, David, that the state Supreme Court may just go the other way and try to weasel out of this thing. It's going to set a very dangerous precedent.
Well, obviously, that's part of the equation. You know, these the state support, the Supreme Court justices are politicians. They each serve 4-year terms and are subject to being voted out. You know, when they come up for re-election, and so I'm counting on them to be able to look in their districts. You know, they're all elected geographically in 7 Supreme Court districts across the state, and in 4, if not 5 of those, it's going to be really bad for that politician judge to be labeled as, oh, well, that's one of the Obamacare judges. And so that's where I think that it's a strong likelihood that we're going to get a fair hearing and a fair hearing and a clear reading of the law. That works very strongly to my advantage, but sure, it could work the other way, and in which case we have, you know, what they're going to have to do, and this is another thing I think is my saving grace, but would also be, you know, the paper trail that's being created here by fighting this. Even if it's just fighting it, and we do lose, they're going to have a Supreme Court majority decision that writes that KRS 12.028, temporary reorganization statute, really doesn't mean anything. In fact, the whole rule of law thing that we've been playing with for the last 200 years or so doesn't really mean anything. And that, you know, when the governor wants to write, when he wants to make a new law, he just writes it down. And I don't think, but if we are, That'll be a great rallying point for turning things back around.
Well, David, I thank you very much for coming on the show.
All right, folks, that's the show. I hope you enjoyed this best of presentation of Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. Next week, we will be back live with co-host Dave and your calls talking about the issues of the day. So until then, I hope everyone has a good week. Be safe out there. Happy Easter. We'll see you in a week.